Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about John Locke, a famous British philosopher from mid-1600s to 1704, where he eventually died. We're reading from the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Turns out to be actually a very good source on the topic. And he's a critical philosopher in terms of getting up to the idea of looking at what ideas is and how empiricism goes into actually the formation of what are sort of basic thoughts, relational thoughts, and mode thoughts. So I've just got to, as I've read them, I've just got to go back in my head. So he wrote an essay on that, and was the butt of a period of time in Europe where there was a lot of religious persecution, a lot of governments which were changing, and he and indeed England got rid of their monarch. I think it was James or Charles, a Catholic, and replaced it with the Dutch one. And so the English said, press the reset button, and he sort of developed philosophy in line with that. There's also the philosophy of the emerging English colonies, which were eventually turned into the United States. A lot of flux coming in the basis of him. And I just have to remember, I just have to remember what the relationships are, what, I just have to remember what modes are, what substance is. So a mode would be a sort of a higher level idea, like virtue or something like that. Whereas a relationship is relational knowledge, like two components together. I've got to really, really concentrate and think deeply about it. Going back, I mentioned another philosopher which I've read. Somehow I feel is similar but in conflict with, I'll have to read him a second time, and that's Bernard Lonergan, 1950s Jesuit philosopher, and see how both also a theory of knowledge. He wrote a book called Insight, and essentially Locke is dealing with insight as well. That is, how do we know? Insight is a theory of knowledge before we get in to the actual processing of knowledge. So if you can actually go into the nature of insight, you can actually debunk a lot of conflict. I also see sort of beyond that, sort of like you can have your group of beliefs, you can look at the insights you get to the group of belief, but you can also have an insight into insight into your insight and the methodology associated with that. This is more your methodology of looking at it. So we're going through, he wrote four books in his book on called The Essay. And book one was a basic introduction to types of knowledge. Book two was dealing with setting yourself up for, it's called nativity, that is, do you have birth-derived thoughts? And he said, no, you don't. You can't have universally implanted thoughts by God. And he used rather an inductive logic process, appealed to it rather than a religious process going through it. And now we're getting on to the third book, which is part D of this Internet Encyclopedia, and it's called Language. And I think coming back from, he's saying that there's obviously something to do with the difference between a word of a concept and the actual concept itself. So I can think of car, and the actual concept with the word car is different. That's really what he has to say here. Book three of The Essay, which is a book of three, four books, is concerned with language. So he's giving it basically a methodology with which to process information rather than necessarily from the church oriented. Lockie admits that this topic is something of a digression. He did not originally plan for language to take up an entire book of the essay, but as soon as he began to realise that language plays an important role in our cognitive lives. There you go. So if you actually want to eliminate a way of thinking, you can ban certain words, we found out. A major proportion of Book 3 is devoted to combating the misuse of language. Lockie believes that improper use of language is one of the greatest obstacles to knowledge and clear thought. He offers a diagnosis of the problem caused by language and recommendations for avoiding these problems. I think many people agree with him nowadays. Lockie believes that language is a tool for communicating with other human beings. Specifically, Lockie thinks we want to communicate about ideas, the content of our minds. From here, there's a short step to the view that, quote, words and their primary or immediate signification stand for nothing, but the ideas in the mind of him that uses them. That's beautiful. When an agent utters the word gold, she is referring to her idea of shiny, yellowish, malleable substance of great value. When she utters the word carrot, she is referring to the idea of a long, skinny, orange vegetable that grows underground. Lockie, of course, is aware that the names we choose for these ideas are arbitrary and merely a matter of social convention. Gee, that's really going... So that's exactly right. There's social... The conventional knowledge, this constructed knowledge. There's knowledge which is constructed for social gain. That is, you know, stuff like that. And then there's all grades and grades of knowledge out there. Although the primary use of the words is to refer to the ideas in the mind of the speaker, Lockie also allows the world to make what he calls secret reference to two other things. Firstly, humans also want their words to refer to the corresponding ideas in the minds of the humans. When Smith says carrot within earship of Jones, her hope is that Jones also has an idea of a long, skinny vegetable and that saying carrot will bring the idea into Jones' mind. After all, communication would be impossible without the supposition that our words correspond to the ideas of minds other. Second, humans suppose that their words stand for the objects in the world. When Smith says carrot, she wants to refer to more than just her ideas. She also wants to refer to a long, skinny object themselves. But Lockie is suspicious of these two other ways of understanding signification. He thinks the latter one, in particular, is illegitimate. After discussing these basic features of language and reference, Lockie goes on to discuss specific cases of the relationship between ideas, words. Words used for simple ideas, words used for modes, words used for substances. Which is always a single word that can refer to a multiplicity of ideas and so forth. That's interesting. So he's got a simple idea, substances, and modes. There's also an interesting chapter on particles. These are words which do not refer to an idea, but instead refer to a certain connection between, which holds between ideas. For example, if I say the secretariat is brown, the word secretariat refers to my idea of a certain racehorse, and brown refers to my idea of colour. The word is, does something different. It's a word, it's a particle, and indicates that I'm expressing something about the relationship between my ideas, secretary, and brown. So secretary is the name of a horse, obviously, and suggesting that they are connected in a certain way. Other particles include words like and, but, hence, and so forth. As mentioned above, the problems of language are a major concern of Book 3. Lockie thinks that language can lead to confusion and misunderstanding from a number of reasons. The signification of words is arbitrary rather than natural. This means that it can be difficult to understand which words refer to which ideas. Many of our words stand for ideas which are complex, hard to acquire, or both. So many people will struggle to use those words appropriately, and in some cases people will even use words when they have no corresponding idea and only very confused adequate corresponding idea. Lockie claims that this is exacerbated by the fact that we are often taught words before we have any idea what they signify. A child, for example, might be taught the word government at a young age, but will take into years to form a clear idea what governments are and how they operate. People also use words inconsistently or equivocate on their meaning. Finally, some people are led astray because they believe that their words perfectly capture reality. Recall from the above, people secretly and incorrectly use their word to refer to objects in the external world. The problem is that people might be very wrong about those objects alike. This, I find this is so scarily true. So I think the people who don't question their words are perhaps the most dangerous of them all. Lockie thinks that as a result of all this is that people are seriously misusing language, and that many debates and discussions in important fields of science, politics, philosophy are confused or consist of merely verbal disputes. Lockie provides a number of examples of language causing problems. Cartesians using body and extension interchangeably, even though the two ideas are distinct. I like that. Physiologists who agree on all the facts yet have a long dispute because they have different understandings of the word liquor. Scholastic philosophers using the term prime matter when they are unable to actually frame an idea of such a thing, and so forth. The remedies that Locke recommends for fixing these problems created by language are somewhat predictable, but Locke is quick to point out they, while they sound easy fixes, they are actually quite difficult to implement. First and most important step is to only use words that we have clear ideas attached to them. Again, that sounds easy, but many of us might actually struggle to come up with a clear idea corresponding to everyday terms such as glory or fascist. We must strive to make sure that the ideas attached to the terms are as complete as possible. We must strive to ensure that we use words consistently and do not equivocate. Every time we utter a word, we should use it to signify one and the same idea. Finally, we should communicate our definitions of words to others. Of course, you've got to add on top of this people who are basically crooks and criminals. They will use words, but with contempt. There's sort of, I believe that there's an assumption of earnest wanting to be clear. People may not want to be clear and can use lack of clarity to move people about the place. The Account of Knowledge, Book 4, having already explained how the mind is furnished with ideas, it has, Lockie moves to discuss knowledge and belief. A good place to start is with a quote from the beginning of the Book 4. Knowledge then seems to me to be nothing but the perception of a connection and agreement and disagreement, repugnancy of any of our ideas. Where this perception is, there is knowledge, and where there is not, there is, we may fancy, guess or belief, yet we always come short of knowledge. Lockie spends the first part of Book 4 clarifying and exploring this conception of knowledge. The second part focuses how we should apportion belief in cases where there's lack of knowledge. Good God, my head's hurting at this point in time, but I suppose it's attitudes. Like, there can be three people there, and the person who's confident that they know things and really don't can actually assume leadership and game the system and force everyone to follow him. Okay, what does Lockie mean by, quote, the connection and agreement and disagreement and recurrency of our ideas? Some examples might help. Bring to mind your idea of white and your idea of black. Lockie thinks that upon doing this, you will immediately perceive they are different. They disagree. It's when you perceive this disagreement that you know the fact that white is not black. Those acquainted with the American geography will know that Bose is in Idaho. On Lockie's account of knowledge, this means that they are able to perceive a certain connection that obtains between the ideas of Idaho and their idea of Bose. This is obviously the University of something or other. Just see where he is. The University of Iowa, I think it is. Iowa. So Idaho and Iowa. Obviously, I don't know if they're different places, obviously. On Lockie's account of knowledge, this means that they are perceived to be certain connections that obtain between the ideas of Idaho and their idea of Bose. Lockie enumerates four dimensions along which there might be this sort of agreement or disagreement between ideas. First, we can perceive when two ideas are identical or non-identical. For example, knowing that sweetness is not bitterness consists of perceiving that the idea of sweetness is not identical to the idea of bitterness. Second, we can perceive the relations that obtain between the idea. Good God. God, this is very similar to what I've come up independently. Let's see. So, A, not B, the relationship between A and B. A and not A, the relationship between A and not A, which is A, not A, also slightly different. But I think this is very necessary. It's amazing that if I've come up with the same thought. Okay, second, we perceive the relationship between ideas. For example, knowing that 7 is greater than 3 consists of perceiving that the relationship of bigger and smaller between the two ideas. Third, we can perceive when our idea of a certain feature accompanies our idea of a certain thing. If I know ice is cold, and this is because I perceive my idea of cold always accompanies my idea of ice. Fourthly, we can perceive when existence agrees with any ideas. I have a knowledge of this fourth kind when, for example, I perform the cognita and recognize a special relationship between my idea of myself and my idea of existence. That is so close to what I developed numerically for English called quadrants, where you actually database quadrant for every single word and then the computers can interpret without doubt your meaning. Locke thinks that all our knowledge consists in agreements or disagreements of one of these types. After detailing the types of relations between ideas which constitute knowledge, Locke continues to discuss 3 degrees of knowledge. Now, this is interesting. These degrees consist different ways of knowing something. The first degree of knowledge calls intuitive knowledge. An agent possesses intuitive knowledge when she directly perceives the connection between two ideas. This is the best kind of knowledge, as Locke says, such kinds of truths the mind perceives at first sight of ideas together are bare intuition without intervention of another idea, and this kind of knowledge is in the clearest and most certain and humane frailty is capable of. The second degree of knowledge is called demonstrative, when it is possible to perceive an immediate connection between ideas. For example, most of us are unable to tell the 3 interior angles of a triangle are equal and with 2 right angles simply by looking at them. Most of us are unable to tell that 3 interior angles of a triangle are equal to 2 right angles. But most of us, with the assistance of a mathematics teacher, can be made to see they are equal by means of geometric proof or demonstration. This is the model of discriminative knowledge. Even if one is unable to directly perceive a relationship between idea X and idea Y, one might perceive a relationship indirectly by means of idea A and idea B. This will be possible if the agent of has intuitive knowledge of a connection between X and A and B and A and between B and Y. Demonstrative knowledge consists, therefore, in a string of relationships, each known intuitively. Okay, this is actually making my head hurt, but indeed this is true. This is sort of like another dimension between the intuition deduction. Okay, the third degree of knowledge is called sensitive knowledge and has been a source of considerable debate and confusion among Locke's commentators. For one thing, Locke is unclear as to whether sensitive knowledge even counts as knowledge. He writes that intuitive and demonstrative knowledge are, properly speaking, the only forms of knowledge, but that, quote, there is indeed another perception of the mind which, going beyond bare possibility and yet not reaching perfectly to either, the foregoing degrees of certainty passes under the name of knowledge. Sensitive knowledge has to do with the relationship between ideas and objects in the external world that produce them. Locke claims that we can be certain that we perceive, something, an orange for example, there is an object in the external world that is responsible for these sensations. Part of Locke's claim is that there is a serious qualitative difference between biting into an orange and remember biting into an orange. There is something in the phenomenological experience of the former which assures us the corresponding object is in the external world. bit deep to think of it. Locke spends a fair amount of the time in book four responding to worries that he's a skeptic, or his account of knowledge with the emphasis on ideas fails to be responsive to the external world. The general worry for Locke is fairly simple. By claiming that the ideas are only things humans have epistematic access to, and by claiming that knowledge relates only to our ideas, Locke seems to rule out the claim that we can ever know about the external world. Lockean agents are trapped behind a veil of ideas, thus we cannot have any assurance that our ideas provide us with reliable information about the external idea world. It's a bit like Total Recall or The Matrix, I suppose. We cannot know, it's a glitch in The Matrix, I can remember lots of people joke about that. We cannot know what it would be for an idea to resemble and represent an object. We cannot tell without the ability to step outside our own minds whether our ideas is reliable. This criticism has historically been thought to endanger Locke's entire project. Gilbert Ryle's memorable assessment is that, quote, nearly every youthful student of philosophy can and does in his second essay refute Locke's entire theory of knowledge. Recent scholarship has been much more charitable to Locke, but the central problem is still a progressing one, that is, inside the veil of ideas. Confusion. I've got to really think about this. Okay, debate about correctly understanding of sensitive knowledge is obviously important when considering these issues. So what the heck is sensitive knowledge? At first blush, the relation involved in sensitive knowledge seems to be a relation between the idea and the physical object in the world. But if this reading is correct, then it becomes difficult to understand many passages in which Locke insists the knowledge is a relation that holds only between ideas. Also relevant are debates about how to correctly understand Lockean ideas. Recall from the above that although many understand ideas as mental objects, some understand them as mental acts. While most of the text seems to favour this first interpretation, it seems that the second interpretation has a significant advantage when responding to these sceptical worries. The reason is that the connection between ideas and external world objects is built right into the definition of an idea. The idea just is the perception of the external world and object. I really think that we're going off a goat track here, but however, the debates discussed in the previous paragraph are resolved. There is a consensus among commentators, oh God, that Locke believes the scope of human understanding is very narrow. Humans are not capable of very much knowledge. Locke discusses this in 4.3, the chapter entitled The Extent of Human Knowledge. The fact is that our knowledge is so limited it should come as no surprise. We have already discussed the ways in which our ideas of substances are problematic. And we have just seen that we have no real understanding of the connection between our ideas and the objects that produce them. Belief system that you go track, you go down. The Greeks actually believe that your eyes produce the light which illuminates the world outside. It's a pretty amazing idea. The good news, however, is that while our knowledge might not be very extensive, it is sufficient for our needs. Locke's memorable nautical metaphor holds that 'tis of great use to the sailor to know the length of his line, though he cannot with it fathom all the depths of the ocean. 'Tis well he knows that it is long enough to reach the bottom at such places as necessary to direct his voyage, and caution him against running upon shoals that may ruin him. Our business here is not to know all things but those which concern our conduct. Locke thinks that we have enough knowledge to live comfortable lives on earth, to realize that there is God, to understand morality and behave appropriately and gain salvation. Our knowledge of morality in particular is very good. Locke even suggests that we might develop a demonstrable system of morality similar to Euclid's demonstrable system of geometry. And that is beautiful. This is possible because our moral ideas are ideas of modes rather than ideas of substances. I like that. And our idea of modes do much better in Locke's evaluative system than our ideas of substances do. Finally, the limits of our knowledge might be disappointing. Locke notes that recognizing these limits is important and useful insofar as it will help us to better organize our intellectual inquiry. We will be saved from investigating questions which we could never know the answers to, and can focus our efforts on areas where progress is possible. Okay, well, I suppose I've got different ideas about the limits of human knowledge. I also think that people can give up thinking and get away with getting. They think, rather than think, trying to work problems out, they just say, let's cut to the chase and get what I can out of the situation. And there's a problem of information. You know, the information about what someone's thinking and why they're thinking is important. It's sort of a game theory of the hygiene. One benefit of Locke's somewhat bleak assessment is of the scope of our knowledge was that it has caused him to focus on the area, an area which underappreciated by many of his contemporaries. This was the arena of judgment or opinion, belief states which fall short of knowledge. Given that we have so little knowledge that we can be certain of so little, the realm of probability becomes very important. I like this. Recall that knowledge consists of perceived agreement and disagreement between two ideas. Belief that falls short of knowledge, judgment or opinion consists in a presumed agreement of a disagreement between two ideas. Consider an example. I'm not entirely sure who the Prime Minister of Canada is, but I'm somewhat confident it's Stephen Harper. Lockheed's claim is that in judging that it is a Canadian PM is Stephen Harper. I'm acting as though a relationship holds between the two ideas. I do not directly perceive a connection between my ideas of Stephen Harper and my ideas of the Canadian PM, but I assume that one exists. After offering this account of what judgment is, Locke offers an analysis of how and why we should form opinions we do, and offers some recommendations for forming opinions reasonably. This includes a diagnosis of errors people make in judging, a discussion of different degrees of assent, and an increasing discussion of epistematic value of testimony. I suppose the other thing is that my view is that people don't know and therefore make captain's calls on reality. Hello, Julian. Three special topics in the essay. So that's in general. My brain's hurting. I don't know whether I'm going to remember any of this. Special topics in the essay. This is section 3. As discussed above, the main project of the essay is an examination of human understanding and analysis of knowledge. But the essay is a rather expansive work and contains discussion of many other topics of philosophical interest. Some of these will be discussed below. A word of warning, however, is required before proceeding. It can sometimes be difficult to tell whether Locke takes himself to be offering a metaphysical theory or whether he is merely describing a component of human psychology. For example, we might question whether his account of personal identity is meant to give the necessary and sufficient conditions for a metaphysical account of personhood, or whether it is merely designed to tell us what sorts of identity attributions we should do and why should make and why. We may further question whether, when discussing primary and secondary qualities, Locke is offering a theory about how perception really works, or whether this discussion is a mere digression used to illustrate the point about the nature of ideas. So while many of these topics have received a great deal of attention, their precise relationship to the main project of the essay can be difficult to locate. Section A of 3. Primary and secondary qualities. Book 2, Chapter 8 of the essays contains an extended discussion of the distinction between primary and secondary qualities. Locke was hardly original in making this distinction. By the time the essay was published, it had been made by many others and was even somewhat commonplace. That said, Locke's formulation of the distinction and his analysis of the related issues has been tremendously influential and has provided a framework for much of the subsequent discussions of the topic. So, essentially, we've got to know what a primary and secondary quality is. I hope they'll discuss it. Lockheed defines a quality as a power that a body has to produce ideas in us. So, a simple object like a baked potato, which can be produced the idea of brownness, heat, ovular shape, solidity, and determined size, must have a series of corresponding qualities. There must be something in the potato which gives us the idea of brown, something in the potato which gives us the idea of ovular shape, and so on. The primary and secondary quality distinction claims that some of these qualities are very different from others. Lockheed motivates the distinction between two types of qualities by discussing how a body could produce an idea in us. The theory of perception endorsed by Lockheed is highly mechanical. All perceptions occur as a result of motion and collision. If I smell a baked potato, there must be small material particles flying off the potato and bumping into the nerves of my nose. The motion of the nose nerves causes a chain reaction along my nervous system until eventually there's some motion in my brain which I experience a certain idea of smell. If I see a baked potato, there must be small material particles flying off the potato and bumping into my retina. This is pretty amazing because, I mean, this is Newton and Descartes. That bumping causes a similar chain reaction and ends in my experience of a round shape. From this, Lockheed infers that for an object to produce an idea in us, it must really have some features that completely lack other features. This mechanical theory of perception requires that objects producing an idea in us have shape, extension, mobility, and solidity. But it does not require that these objects have colour, taste, and sound and temperature. So the primary qualities are the qualities actually possessed by the bodies. These are the features of the bodies that a body that cannot be without. The secondary qualities, by contrast, are not really had by the bodies. They are just ways of talking about the ideas that can be produced in us by bodies in virtue of their primary qualities. So when we claim that a baked potato is solid, this means that the solidity is one of the fundamental features. But when I claim that it smells a certain kind of earthy kind of way, this means that fundamental feature are capable of producing the idea of earthy smell in my mind. This claim leads Lockheed to claim about resemblance, from whence I think it is easy to draw observations. The ideas on primary qualities of bodies are resemblance of them, and their patterns do really exist in the bodies themselves. But the ideas produced in us by these are secondary qualities, have no resemblance to them at all. Insofar as my idea of potato is something solid, extended and mobile and possessing a certain shape, my idea accurately captures something about the real nature of potato. But insofar my idea of potato is something of particular smell, temperature and taste, my ideas are not accurately captured mind-dependent facts about the potato. Well, that leaves me a bit cold in terms of, you know, what you do with it. I suppose it's just not the knowledge that it's the moment. Around the time of the essay, the mechanical philosophy was emerging as the predominant theory about the physical world. Mechanical philosophy held that fundamental entities in the physical world were small individual bodies called corpuscles. Each corpuscle was solid, extended, and had a certain shape. These corpuscles could combine together to form ordinary objects like rocks, tables, and plants. The mechanical philosophy argued that all features of these bodies and all natural phenomena could be explained by appeal to these corpuscles and their basic properties, in particular size and shape and motion. This is really interesting because this contradicts a little bit with Descartes, but predicts the emergence of atomic theory. Also interesting that the capacitor theory is the idea of Newton and light. Lockheed was exposed to the mechanical philosophy while in Oxford and became acquainted with the writings of its most prominent advocates. On balance, Lockheed seems Locke seems to have become a convert to mechanical philosophy. He writes, the mechanism is the best available hypothesis for the explanation of nature. And it's really interesting because you've got the Feynman virtual particle diagrams. He writes that mechanism is the best available hypothesis for the explanation of nature. We've already seen that some of the explanatory work done by the mechanism in the essay. The distinction between the primary and secondary qualities was a hallmark of the mechanical philosophy and neatly dovetailed the Mechanicus accounts of perceptions. Locke reaffirms his commitment to the account of perception at a number of points in the essay. Yeah, I sort of can get the secondary quality. This is a smell I now associate it with this. And when discussing material objects, Locke is very often happy to allow that they are composed of material corpuscles. That's atoms and pre-atoms. What is peculiar, however, is that the essay does not seem to have a number of passages in which Locke supports a mechanical explanation and speaks highly of the mechanism. Or does seem to have. It also contains some highly critical remarks about the mechanism and discussions of the limits of the mechanical philosophy. Locke's critique of mechanism can be divided into two strands. First, he recognised that there is a number of observed phenomena which mechanisms struggle to explain. Mechanisms did not offer neat explanations of some observed phenomena. For example, the fact that objects could be seen and but not smelt through glass should be explained by postulating that the corpuscles which interacted with our retinas were smaller than those ones which interacted with our nostrils. So the light corpuscles could pass through the spaces between the glass corpuscles, but the smell corpuscles, corpuscles could be turned away. But other phenomena were harder to explain. Magnetism, isn't that absolutely fascinating? Wow. That's amazing. So they've got no idea of a photon or a wave or, oh, it's just amazing. And surprisingly, I think there are teachers at school which teach pretty much this. Why is glass? You know, what is a photon? Yeah, and stuff like that. Magnetism and various chemicals and logical processes like fermentation were less susceptible to these sorts of explanations. And it's interesting that Descartes, in order to get this explanation going, had magnetic emitting screw particles from it. And these screw particles drew the thing inwards. The universal gravitation, which Locke took Newton to have proved the existence of the principia, was particularly hard to explain. Locke suggested that God may have superadded various non-mechanical powers to material bodies that could account for the gravitation. Isn't that amazing? That is amazing. And of course, Newton says, back as little, guys, this is what God's going down. We'll understand it later. Come back later. Indeed, at several points, he even suggests that God may have superadded the power of thought to matter and that humans might be purely material things. Locke's second set of critiques pertain to the theoretical problems in mechanical philosophy. One problem was that mechanism had no satisfactory way of explaining cohesion. Why do corpuscles sometimes stick together? If things like tables and chairs are just collections of small corpuscles, they should be very easy to break apart. Wow. Chilling. He's really getting into quantum physics. The same way I can easily separate a group of marbles from another. Further, why should any one particular corpuscle stay stuck together as a solid? What counts for its cohesion? Again, mechanism seemed hard-pressed to offer the answer. Finally, Locke allows that we do not entirely understand the transfer of motion by impact. When one corpuscle collides with another, we actually do not have a very satisfying explanation for why the second one moves away under the force of the impact. Well, there you go. And of course, this is the entire Newtonian collision, that a collision occurs in three components are elastic collision, that is, they come together, elastic energy is stored, and then they swing apart, elastic energy is re-released. It's a three-process step. I have to get into discussing that. Locke presses these critiques with some skill in a serious manner. Still, ultimately, he is guardedly optimistic about mechanism. What's somewhat mixed attitude on Locke's part has led to commentaries to debate questions about his exact attitude towards mechanical philosophy and some motivations for discussing it. I mean, there's a limited amount that you can go back in and surmise. Firstly, if he's right, no one really cares he's right. It's a bit like watching old movies. A lot of the time they're just unwatchable, those 70s cop movies where they finish at the end with a joke. But some movies like Arnold Schwarzenegger's Conan the Barbarian, they're just so badly cut. A so grainy film, and you watch them and they're just a classic in themselves. And this is a bit like watching an old VCR video as I cruise through this horrendous book. Number 20 minutes ago. Blood oath, mate. C. So in 3, and we've done A, B, C. This is memory stuff. I'm really struggling to remember what A and B was. There you go. But I'm going to try, mate. In book 2, chapter 22, the essay, Locke explores the topic of the will. One of the things which separates people from rocks and billiard balls is our ability to make decisions and control our actions. We feel that we are free in certain respects and that we have the power to choose certain thoughts and actions. Locke calls this power the will. But there are tricky questions about what this power consists in and about what it takes to freely or voluntarily choose something. It contains a delicate and sustained discussion of these tricky questions. And to me, it's the most amazing thing, obviously, that there are people who are just running a completely different game and getting away with as much as they can. Locke first begins with the questions of freedom and then proceeds to the discussion of will. On Locke's analysis, we are free to do those things which we both will to do and are physically capable of. For example, I wish to jump into the lake and have no physical maladies which prevents it, then I'm free to jump into the lake. But in contrast, if I don't wish to jump into the lake, but a friend pushes me, I did not act freely when I entered the water. Or, if I wish to jump into the lake, but have a spinal injury and can't move my body, then I do not freely act when I stay on the shore. So far, so good. Locke has offered us a useful way of differentiating our voluntary actions and involuntary ones. But there's still a pressing question about freedom and the will. That of whether the will is itself free. When I'm deciding whether or not to jump into the water, is the will determined by outside factors to choose one or the other? Or can it, so to speak, make up its own mind and choose either option? Locke's initial position in the chapter is that the will is determined. But in the later section, he offers a qualification of sorts. In normal circumstances, the will is determined by what Locke calls uneasiness. What is that determines the will in regard to our actions? And for the most part, the most pressing uneasiness a man is at present under, that is that which successively determines the will, and that sets us upon those actions we perform, whatever that means. The uneasiness is caused by the absence of something that is perceived as good. The perception of a thing as good gives rise to desire for that thing. Suppose I choose to eat a slice of pizza. Locke would say, I must have made this choice because the absence of pizza was troubling me somehow. I was feeling hunger pangs or longing for something savoury. And this discomfort gave rise to the desire of food. That desire in turn determined my will to choose to eat pizza. Locke's qualification to this account of the will being determined by uneasiness has to do with what he calls suspension. Beginning with the second edition of the essay, Locke began to argue that the most pressing desire for the most part determines the will, but not always. Quote, for the mind having in most cases, as evidenced in the experience, the power to suspend the execution and satisfaction of any of its desires, and so all, one after the other, is the liberty to consider the objects of them, examine them on all sides, and weigh them up with others. So even at this moment, my desire for pizza is strongest desire. Locke thinks I can pause a moment while I decide to eat the pizza or consider the decision. I consider other items in my desire set. My desire to lose weight, or to leave the pizza for my friend, or to keep a vegan diet. He keeps on going. I like this author. Okay. Careful consideration of the other possibilities might have the effect of changing my desire set. If I really focus on how important it is to stay fit and healthy by eating nutritious foods, then my desire to leave the pizza might become stronger than my desire to eat it. To leave this pizza may be stronger to eat it. And my will may be determined to choose not to eat the pizza. But, of course, we can always ask whether a person has a choice whether or not to suspend judgment, or whether the suspension of judgment is itself determined by the mind's strongest desire. On this point, Locke is somewhat vague, or most interpreters think that our desires determine when judgment is suspended, or others disagree and argue suspension of judgment offers Lockean agents a robust form of free will. The entire thing is that it's all over. What if you are competing against a slick pizza eater? You know, it's this entire competitive game theory action which confuses this at no end. D. Personhood and personal identity. Locke was one of the first philosophers to give serious attention to the question of personal identity, and his discussion of the question has proved influential both historically and in the present day. This discussion occurs in the midst of Locke's larger discussion of identity conditions from various entities in the book 2, chapter 27. At heart, the question is a simple that makes me this, is simple. What makes me the same person as the person who did certain things in the past and will do certain things in the future? In what sense is me that attended the Bildung Elementary School many years ago? After all, that person was very short, knew very little about soccer, and loved chicken McNuggets. I, on the other hand, am average height, know tons of soccer trivia, and get rather queasy at the thought of eating chicken, especially in nugget form. Nevertheless, it is true that I am identical to the boy who attended Bridal Mile. In Locke's time, the topic of personal identity was important for religious reasons. Christian doctrine held that there was an afterlife in which virtuous people would be rewarded in heaven. Sinful people would be punished in hell. This scheme provided motivation for individuals to behave morally, but for this work, it was important that the person who was rewarded or punished was the same person as the one who lived virtuously or lived sinfully. And this had to be true even though the person being rewarded or punished had died, or somehow continued to exist in an afterlife, and had somehow managed to be reunited with the body. And so it was important to get the issue of personal identity right. I love this. It's a bit sassy. Locke's view on personal identity involved a negative project and a positive project. The negative project involves arguing against the view of personal identity consists in or requires the continued existence of a particular substance. And the positive project involves defending the view that personal identity consists in continuity of consciousness. We can begin with a positive view. Locke defines a person as, quote, a thinking intelligent being that has a reason and reflection and consider itself as itself. And same thinking with thing in different times and places, which it does not only by consciousness, which is inseparable from thinking and is, it seems to me, essential to it. This is interesting to me in terms of dementia, you know, when you just lose the sense of self. I'll suggest that there, here, that a part of what makes a person the same throughout their, is their ability to recognize past experiences as belonging to them. For me, the past difference is a little boy who attended Brittle Meal Elementary from all the other children who went there is my realization that I share his consciousness. Put differently, my access to his lived experiences at Brittle Meal is very different from my access to a lived experience of others there. It is this first personal and immediate. I recognize his experience there as part of a string of experiences that make up my life and join up to my self and current experiences in a unified way. That is what makes him the same person as me. Locke believes this account of personal identity as continuity of consciousness obliterates the need for an account of a personal identity given in terms of substances. A traditional view that there was a metaphysical entity, a soul, which guaranteed personal identity throughout time. Wherever there was the same soul, the same person would be there as well. Locke offers a number of thought experiments to cast doubt on this belief and show this account is his account is superior. For example, if a soul was wiped clean of all previous experiences and given new ones, as might be the case of in reincarnation or truth, the same soul would not justify the claim that all of those who had it were the same person, or we could imagine two souls that had their consciousness experiences completely swapped. In this case, we would want to say that the person went with the conscious experiences did not remain with the soul, which is sort of interesting. My overview is not so much your own personal view, it's just whether your view or construct of someone else's soul and they contradict it, you know, what goes on there. That is, if I've lampooned someone and, you know, I've been in a situation where someone has been criticised and put down, and that's my existence of them, and it contradicts it, am I able to change it? I suppose that's my question I have. Locke's account of personal identity seems to be a deliberate attempt to move away from some of the metaphysical alternatives and to offer an account which would be acceptable to individuals from a number of different theological backgrounds. Of course, a number of serious challenges have been raised for Locke's account. Most of these focus on the crucial role seemingly played by memory and the precise details of Locke's positive proposal in 2.27, they have been hard to pin down. Nevertheless, many contemporary philosophers believe that there is an important kernel of truth about Locke's analysis. There's just so many things. I really would like a graph here. There's primary and secondary qualities. There's substances, modes, relationships, simple and complex ideas all going through, and the sense of self. E. Section E of Part 3 for his essay. Real and nominal essences. Locke's distinction between real essence of a substance and a nominal essence of a substance is one of the most fascinating components of the essay. Scholastic philosophers held that the main goal of metaphysics and science is to learn about the essence of things. The key metaphysical components of things which explained all the interesting features. Locke thought this project was misguided. That sort of knowledge of a real essence of beings, is unavailable to human beings. This led Locke to suggest an alternative way to understand and investigate nature. He recommends focusing on nominal essence of things. So, that's what we want to get in. When Locke introduces the term of real essences, he uses it to refer to the real constitution of a thing, which is the foundation of all those properties that are combined in it and are constantly found to coexist with the object. For scholastics, the real essence would be an object's substantial form. For proponents of mechanical velocity, it would be the number and arrangement of material corpuscles in composed the bodies. Corpuscles. So the corpuscles is that sort of like an envelope for an atom, which you don't know where to put the actual atom in. He sometimes endorses the latter understanding of real essence, but he insists that these real essences are entirely unknown and undiscoverable to us. The nominal essences, by contrast, are known and are the best way we have to understand individual substances. Nominal essences are just collections of all the observed features of an individual thing has. So the nominal essence of a piece of gold would be include the ideas of yellowness, certain weight, malleability, dissolvability, and certain chemicals, and so on. So that's interesting. So one is the actual quantum mechanical wave functions, the other is the computer rendition in a matrix somewhere. Locke offers us a helpful analogy to illustrate the differences between real and nominal essences. He suggests our position with respect to ordinary objects is like the position of someone looking at a very complicated clock. The gears, wheels, weights and pendulums that produce the motions of the hands on the clock, face, the real essence, are unknown to the person. They are hidden behind the casing. He or she can only know about the observable features like the clock's shape, the movement of the hands, the chime of the hours, the clock's normal essence. Similarly, when I look at an object like a dandelion, I'm only able to observe the normal essence, the yellow colour, the bitter smell, and so forth. I have no idea what produces the features of the dandelion and how they are produced. Well, no, you don't, but eventually you can get the quantum mechanical wave functions, the Fibonacci series, you can sort of get in and actually get artifacts of the neural knowledge. There's also about weather. I was just thinking supercomputer simulations of weather or anything like that. Locke's, now, it's also interesting information theory in that, like I can get a simply sufficiently small thing like a hydrogen atom and I can completely represent it in a computer. Locke's view on real and nominal essence have important consequences for his views about the division of objects into groups and sorts. Why do we consider some things to be zebras and other things to be rabbits? Locke's view is that we group according to nominal essence, not according to unknown real essence. But this has a consequence that our groupings might fail to ethically reflect whatever real distinction there might be in nature. So Locke, who is not a realist about the species of, is not a realist about species or types. Instead, he is a conventionalist. We project these divisions onto the world when we choose to classify objects as falling under the various nominal essences we've created. I suppose it's really interesting in that, you can actually apply a lot of quantum mechanical wave function theory directly to Leibniz. And here, again, there's certain aspects of it. F. Religious epistemology. The epistemology of religion claims about our understanding of God and the duties with respect to him were tremendously contentious during Locke's lifetime. The English Civil War fought during Locke's use, this is really interesting, was in large part a disagreement over the right way to understand the Christian religion and the requirements of religious faith. Throughout the 17th century, a number of fundamentalist Christian sects continuously threatened the stability of the English political life. The status of Catholic and Jewish people in England was a vexed one. So, the stakes are very high when, in 4.18, Locke discussed the nature of faith and reason in the restrictive domains. He defines reason as an attempt to discover the certainty or probability through the use of natural facilities in the investigation of the world. Faith, by contrast, which is interesting in terms of Bacon, you know, we use religion to improve our lot after the fall. Faith, by contrast, is certainty or probability attained through communication believed to have come originally from God. So when Smith eats a potato chip and comes to believe it's salty, she believes this according to reason. But when Smith believes that Joshua made the sun and stands still in the sky because she read it in the Bible, which she takes to be divine revelation, she believes it according to faith. And really there is these two things, and there's also a belief that you then have a belief about whether Smith is a good person. So there's all that knowledge, so that's just my head's hurting thinking about it. Although initially it sounds as though Lockie has carved out quite separate roles for faith and reason, it must be noted that these definitions make faith subordinate to reason in a subtle way. For, as Lockie explained, whatever God hath revealed is certainly true, no doubt can be made of it. This is the proper object of faith. But wherever it be divine revelation or no, reason must be judged, which can never permit the mind to reject the greater evidence to embrace what is less evidence, nor allow certain probability in opposition to knowledge and certainty. Alright, so it's sort of like a Christian Scientist that you've got to believe your test tube. First, Lockie thinks that any proposition, even one which purports to be divinely related, clashes with clear evidence of reason, then it should not be believed. So, even if it seems like it's telling us that 1 plus 1 equals 3, Lockie claims we should go on believing 1 plus 1 equals 2, and we should deny that 1 plus 1 equals 3 revelation was genuine. Second, Lockie thinks that to determine whether or not something is divinely revealed, we have to exercise our reason. How can we tell whether the Bible contains God's direct revelation conveyed through the inspired biblical authors, or whether instead it was the work of mere humans? Only reason can help us settle that question. Lockie thinks that those who ignore the importance of reason in determining what is and what is not a matter of faith are guilty of enthusiasm. And, in a chapter added in later editions to the essay, Locke sternly warns his readers against the serious dangers posed by this intellectual vice. I love that. In all this, Lockie emerges as a strong moderate. He himself was deeply religious and took religious faith to be important, but he also felt there was a serious limit to what could be justified through appeal to faith. The issues discussed in this section will be very important below, where Lockie reviews the importance of religious toleration, Lockie's views on the importance of religious tolerations are discussed. Thanks for listening. I'll get this away at roughly an hour of talking. Thanks a lot. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.